This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off, Skip.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, and here we go, because I'm going to share something here with you that you're not going to hear anyplace else, probably. And it's an important conversation because it's instructive on systemic bias in America and the news media. Back in the late 1980s, I was really proud because I won 3 Associated Press Awards for news coverage. And to me, it was my first real accolade, accomplishment, if you will, in this industry. And I won these AP Awards for radio news coverage. And it must have been like 1986, 87, somewhere in there. And the Associated Press has been, I don't know, the guide, if you will. And one of the guiding lights in journalism. The Associated Press was a place of respect and integrity, but that's not true anymore. In fact, it's not true at all. Because the Associated Press has a style book. It tells you how to write certain things, how to refer to certain things. The Associated Press style book sits in newsrooms around America and around the world. So when you talk about different stories, it will instruct you how to refer to different things and different people in different situations. The original intent of word preference was to use words that are more neutral than others. But in recent years, the concept has changed. A journalism style book is supposed to provide universal guidelines for writers when it comes to stylistic things like punctuation, capitalization, so on. And they prefer certain words over others. But more often than not, style writers have been more interested in censoring conservative words. And now this comes from Rachel Alexander. And she took the time to sort out some of these egregious violations and some of these egregious attacks upon the integrity. It's unfortunate about the AP because the guide is the one that most journalists rely on, especially young journalists just getting into the business that are in a newsroom somewhere and they're 25 years old and they're being told by their boss, you need to go by the AP style book, because that's what I was told when I was 25 years old, from what I can remember being 25 years old. And even when authors don't adhere to the AP style book, when you submit that article for submission, it will be changed. It will be edited by people up the line somewhere so that the politically correct verbiage is added. Let me give you an example. A pro-life author who submits a piece taking a position against abortion will see the words pro-life changed now to anti-abortion, giving it a negative connotation. The AP style book instructs you use anti-abortion instead of pro-life and pro-abortion rights instead of pro-abortion or pro-choice. It goes on, avoid abortionist, saying the term connotes a person who performs clandestine abortions. Words related to terrorism, completely sanitized in the new Associated Press style book. Militant, lone wolves, or attackers are to be used instead of the word terrorist. And certainly not the word Islamist. You can't use the word refugee or migrant either. You can't use the term refugee, referring to all of the refugees, frankly, streaming into Europe. You must call those folks people struggling to enter Europe. I kid you not. I can't even make that one up. People struggling to enter Europe, not refugees or migrants, or certainly not illegal aliens. While it's true that many struggle to enter Europe, it is accurate to point out they are, in fact, refugees from war-torn regions. These are not just dangerous guidelines. They're dishonest guidelines from the Associated Press. Illegal immigrant and undocumented aren't acceptable anymore either, by the way. Illegals and alien were already forbidden a few years ago. That's why we use the term here, illegal alien, because it's legally accurate. And well, frankly, accurate all the way around. Although illegal immigration is still acceptable, it's not clear what words are supposed to replace the forbidden words. The Stylebook also instructs writers to use confusing language about guns. I know that shocks you, in order to create a negative impression about them. Semi-automatic rifles that have add-on parts intended to increase shooting accuracy are strictly to be called assault weapons, despite the fact the term has referred to fully automatic weapons used by the military for years. The latter are now referred to as assault rifles, and the two are often conflated. Adding even more to the confusion, the phrase military style recommended to describe assault weapons. Military style assault weapons. Even those owned by civilians, usually far different than the military versions. AK-47s, which have been used in some, very few in fact, fatal shootings, used to be fully automatic military weapons used by the Russians. That's no longer the case. But the style book still instructs they be labeled AK-47 assault rifles. Separately, the phrase climate change deniers is everywhere today in news articles. This is because the style book instructs the following: to describe those who don't accept climate science or dispute that the world is warming from man-made forces, use climate change doubters or those who reject mainstream climate science. Avoid the use of skeptics or deniers. The entry includes an extensive discussion with seemingly authoritative evidence of man-made global warming. This is the AP style book. They're making calls on what is true and what is not. These words tell the reader that climate change is true and mainstream. Another problem found here: journalists don't always use the AP style book when it would water down words that favor liberals. For example, the guide instructs journalists to try to avoid describing political leanings. However, journalists usually ignore the guide in referring to Republicans as right-wing. At the same time, they almost never describe Democrats as left-wing, except here, where it's accurate and honest. The AP also discourages the use of the phrase ultra-rightist, defined as an individual who subscribes to rigid interpretations of conservative doctrine. You know, crazy things like the Constitution. Well, let's go to Joe in Owosso. I'm still digging through this. Joe in Owosso, what's on your mind on the hotline?
Well, Steve, you just reinforced that I've called it before, that, you know, humans are dumbing down. Okay, my favorite, and this is when I see it started, is that probably, what was it, 10 or 15 years ago, if a person was involved in an accident with a sport utility vehicle, it was always just written as the person was killed by an SUV.
Yeah.
And I thought that was great, because I thought to myself, okay, where do I see that the SUV is the culprit? It's the driver that's in the SUV, and it doesn't matter, you know, what type of vehicle is. There was that accident that took somebody else. So you just continue to reinforce, and I don't know if it gets back to the...
I'm trying to help everybody out, Joe. I'm trying to make it clear. I greatly appreciate you calling and listening. It's Tuesday. This is the Steve Gerber Show.
Getting your day started with news from around the state and around the world. Common Sense Radio. This is the Steve Gruber Show.
In our city, there's a thousand things I want to say to you. But whenever I approach you...
You know, I'm going back to the Associated Press style guide here, referring to... you cannot call people deniers, right? You have to call people climate change doubters or those who reject mainstream climate science. You must refer to those who don't believe in global warming as those who reject mainstream climate science. According to the Associated Press, that's what you must do. And I use the word integrity, and the lack thereof. The Associated Press has no integrity left. That's the problem. It used to be a good organization. Paul Dreesen joining me now, senior policy advisor for the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, CFACT. which is sponsoring the All Pain, No Gain petition against global warming hype, the crisis of integrity, deficient science, fueled, as we have just learned, by the Associated Press and their deficient integrity. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Steve.
Glad to have you here. You say there is an epidemic of agenda-driven science by press release and falsification, and that we've reached a crisis situation. Please explain.
Seeing over and over a pattern of falsifying data, homogenizing is their favorite word, where they just sort of adjust the data that they've actually gotten to fit the agenda, to fit the theory. You see this with global warming, the original data sets, even going back all the way to the 1930s, are adjusted upward or downward to make everything fit with the narrative that humans are causing dangerous man-made climate change. So in this case that I just wrote about, I'm pointing out a couple of very troubling instances. One involved Duke University, where one of its researchers had finally admitted that she had falsified and fabricated data that Duke then used to get $113 million in additional EPA grants from the Environmental Protection Agency, so that the agency could drive forward its narrative that air pollution, soot in our air, was killing people and causing environmental injustice. And then next one I saw, these are all in the space of a week, was
right.
The New England Journal of Medicine, which published some articles and an editorial that claimed the same pollutants that Duke was studying were killing people, but they blatantly ignored a whole raft of studies coming from California and elsewhere that show that there's just no significant or evidence-based relationship between these tiny particles that are...
Well, here's the problem,
soot in
Paul.
The air, and with people getting sick or dying.
Here's the problem, Paul. In my lifetime alone, here in the United States alone, solely in the United States, because other countries have seen far larger jumps, but longevity in America has increased 19% since the mid-1960s in America. 19%. The average woman born today in America will live into her mid-80s, and men now, for the first time, will break 80 years of age on average in America. Now, in places like China, the lifespan went from about 50 years of age to near 70 in the same time period. It's an incredible leap forward in longevity, and yet there's more people, more cars, more greenhouse gas, and so on and so forth than there's ever been. But in America, we're cleaner than we've ever been as well. And please explain. I mean, if we're all killing ourselves with all these pollutants and particulates and so on and so forth, how is it that we are all living longer year after year after year? We live longer, better, more productive lives than at any time in human history.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And if you look back a little bit further, you go to the turn of the 19th century, say 1900 to 2000, we went from about 47 years of age on an average life expectancy to 78. So we are improving our lives, just as you say. We're learning how to control the pollution that we used to put into our air and our water. Our cars are putting out about 3% of the pollution that they did in 1970. And then you have these crazy people over in Hamburg, Germany, protesting and screaming against capitalism and modern industry and modern living standards.
Hold on, Paul.
They are enjoying the same fruits of capitalism.
They're screaming about capitalism
and living standards. They are
using their iPhones.
Longer and better lives.
Yeah, they're screaming about capitalism, using their iPhones, wearing their Nikes with their Under Armour shirts on. I mean, the absurdity of the depth of their ignorance knows no limit.
Yeah, it's the ignorance, and it's driven just by this absolute passionate hatred of what they concoct as what capitalism is all about and what industry and what business are all about. They've just got this crazy stuff pounded into them, into their heads from infancy almost, from teachers and professors who
have the same
attitudes and want to drive this viewpoint that everything in modern history and modern life is evil and aim toward killing people when, as you just said repeatedly, our lives are so much better than they've ever been.
We have longer, more productive, happier lives than at any time in human history. More food, medication, transportation, communication, all perfected in large part by America, by the way. And America's often made out to be the evil actor in all this, and yet we've created a better world for everybody. What we've failed to do effectively in America for the last half century is teach the truth about America, about capitalism, about the evils of socialism and the downfalls of Marxism. And the fault lies in our educational system overall because we haven't taught our kids squat about what they should have been taught. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I think what we're looking at is an educational system that is part of a leftist, anti-capitalist, anti-modern civilization, anti-Western civilization movement that wants to be in charge, wants its way on everything. It feels it's wiser and smarter than all the rest of us, and they should be running our lives, regulating every aspect of our lives, but never with any accountability or liability for what they screw up or for the people that they deliberately hurt. And that is just intolerable in my book.
Well, Paul, you hit it hard. You hit it well. He is Paul Dreesen with the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, CFACT. Paul, I'm sure we will talk soon, my friend. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. My pleasure.
It is Tuesday. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show. Find out more at stevegruber.com. Brought to you by Wolverine Water Systems, Michigan's premier water treatment system. Get your free water test today at wolverinewatersystems.com.
The Steve Gruber Show. American values with Midwestern common sense.
All right. It's something we've talked about here in the past. Certainly not a new idea, because the expansion, the American energy renaissance over the last decade has placed in jeopardy Russia's stranglehold of producing and delivering energy to Europe and other nations. And it's putting a stranglehold on it. America's resurgence has also driven the price of oil down, which is why we've enjoyed cheap gasoline for the last 3 or 4 years now. Cheap. It was over $4 a gallon. You remember that? Now it's been $2, $2.25, $2.50 for a long time. Think about the tens of thousands of dollars you've saved. Well, now we're learning more about the idea, and this is not a necessarily new idea, but it's getting a lot more traction, that Russia is colluding with environmentalist groups to try to drive the narrative that fracking is bad and fracking should go away. Of course they're driving that. I mean, they have no other alternative. Valerie Richardson from the Washington Times joining me now. Valerie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And you wrote a terrific piece about Lamar Smith and Randy Weber, members of Congress, that are saying, listen, it's pretty clear that Russia is funding U.S. environmental groups in an effort to suppress our domestic oil and gas industry, specifically hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, as they call it. Valerie, tell us what you learned.
Yeah, what we saw was that on Friday, the chairman of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, Lamar Smith, he and Randy Weber sent a letter to the Treasury Department, to Steve Mnuchin, asking for an investigation. They'd like the administration to conduct an investigation into whether or not Russia is funding indirectly environmental groups and anti-fracking activism in order to, you know, suppress what you describe as, you know, aptly as an energy revolution in the United States with oil and natural gas. That's being driven by technologies, you know, primarily hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. And because this is not something that's a recent allegation. I mean, I would say for the last 4 or 5 years, you know, you've been hearing speculation that Russia is somehow getting money to these groups, and they lay it out in a letter. In their letter, they cite various reports pointing to the involvement of a group called Klein Limited, which is a shell company in Bermuda. And the way they describe it, Klein Limited is believed to be funneling money from Russia to foundations like the Sea Change Foundation, which is based in San Francisco, which funds a lot of environmental groups.
Let me jump in here. And the Sierra Club, I want to get back to that in just a second. But do these groups know the origin of the money, or are they just obtuse to it all?
No, they would have no reason to know, you know, when they get a donation from Sea Change Foundation, where that money comes from. You know, it could be individuals, it could be, you know, countries like Russia. I mean, they just don't know. So yeah, so you have to point out that, you know, these environmental groups, you know, have there's no reason that they would know where Sea Change's money would be coming from. And Sea Change doesn't have to disclose its donors. It's a 501c3 private foundation. It does not have to tell people where it's getting its money from.
That's kind of
where the secrecy is. And that's what the committee would like to see the Treasury Department track down.
Well, there you go. So I want to jump back to this because this is just kind of a side note of history for folks. John Muir is the man that founded the Sierra Club. And you've probably heard of Glacier Bay. Most people have. But it's interesting to note that in 1870, when John Muir saw Glacier Bay for the first time, you know what was missing from Glacier Bay? Glaciers. Because they had already melted, and that's why it was called Glacier Bay. It wasn't called Glacier Ice Formation. It was called Glacier Bay because it was already gone in 1870. He was an interesting environmentalist and good friends with Teddy Roosevelt later in his life, and it was an important guy who did some important things. But the hysteria, the silliness has got to stop, and the fact that the Russians are paying for it really comes to me as no surprise. Go on.
So in any event, what they're looking for is an investigation into, you know, whether or not Klein is funneling money from Russia. And obviously, you know, if we talk about motive, Russia clearly has motive here. I mean, last month, for the first time, the United States sent natural gas to Poland. Poland has long been, along with the rest of Eastern Europe, Russia's biggest client for its oil exports. All Russia's exports, like 68%. Involve oil, and so if Russia were to lose that edge, and the United States would start encroaching on that market, I mean that would, you know, obviously be pretty devastating for Russia economically.
It would be a game changer.
So cheap in the United States because it's become so easy or so inexpensive to access what with the new technology.
Yeah, I've talked about this for a very long time in this program. It is a game changer. If we can supply liquefied natural gas to Europe, because Europe is often held basically at gunpoint, if you will, especially during the winter months, places like Poland and Hungary and Eastern Europe, because the Russians say, you know what, we're going to raise your price, and if you don't do what we tell you you're going to do, then we're going to just withhold the natural gas altogether. They do that, of course, in the winter when people are trying to heat their homes, and Russia holds them hostage to the energy. America, of course, would never do that. The other part of that is, that all of that money would go into American pockets, American industry, American workers. You and I would benefit because of great taxes coming into America. It's a win for all of us. And so it makes perfect sense that the Russians would try to exploit anything they could on the backs of liberalism, especially, to prevent us from continuing in this renaissance.
And so far, you have to note also, you know, how the environmental movement is doing when it comes to, you know, cracking down on hydraulic fracturing. Three states have banned fracking so far, Maryland, Vermont, and New York. And I will point out that none of those states actually had fracking at the time. Generally, when you see these fracking bans, it's in places that don't have fracking. But New York, the southern tier of New York is right next to Pennsylvania, where you have the Marcellus Shale, which is an enormous resource of oil and natural gas. And the people who live in the southern tier and upstate were very upset when the governor pretty much unilaterally banned fracking in the state, because they're economically struggling. And in fact, there have been movements since he decided to do that, which was in late 2015, to basically say, hey, can we just join Pennsylvania? You know, can we break off this section of New York and maybe, you know, become a part of their state?
Well, here's an important consideration, Valerie. Valerie Richardson here with us from the Washington Times, who did a great piece on the Russian funding of anti-fracking efforts. But here in Michigan, fracking has been going on since 1949, longer than anywhere. Fracking has been conducted in Michigan with no actual adverse effects on the environment. It's a great case study. But there is the possibility coming up in fall of 2018, we could see an anti-fracking measure on the ballot, just like you've seen in Vermont, New York, and Maryland, like you mentioned. So it's a big deal here in Michigan because we do produce natural gas from fracking here in Michigan. We've done it for more than half a century, since 1949, without adverse effects, and it's still going to make it to the ballot. So this connection is extremely important, Valerie. I'll give you the last word.
Thanks for letting me know about Michigan. I know that in Colorado, they've fought a lot of these measures as well. In Colorado, a number of, you know, small liberal cities have passed anti-fracking measures. Those have all been defeated in court, basically. But clearly the movement's got a lot of energy right now, not just from, you know, whether or not Russia's funding them, but from billionaires in San Francisco like Tom Steyer, who put a lot of money into this effort as well.
Delusional billionaires like Tom Steyer, I think is what you meant to say. But you won't say it. I will. It's okay. I'm here to help, Valerie. I'm your guy. Valerie, great conversation. And yes, stay in touch because Michigan could have a ballot initiative, and we've done fracking longer than anyone. Good resource for you. Valerie Richardson from the Washington Times, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There you have it. Valerie Richardson, it's the Steve Gruber Show. We'll be right back.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
You know, the Buy American slogan could be a lot more, if the Trump administration and the president decide to enforce a law from 1980. Because when the feds fund academic research, the resulting inventions are supposed to be, as required by law, to be made in America. When you and I foot the bill, when we put out our tax dollars and fund this research and they find something great in transportation, medication, information, whatever it may be, it's supposed to stay here and be created by Americans. But that law has been, for the most part, forgotten. My next guest, Justin Hughes, teaches international trade and intellectual property courses at Loyola Law School, Los Angeles. Justin, or should I say professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you here, sir. All right, this makes sense to me. The way it used to be, American universities would do research in a variety of places, then hand off their, you know, what they've found oftentimes to American industry. Industry would go to work, and America would prosper. But in large part, a lot of that has been forgotten. Even this 1980 law, which has been more recent, things have changed. What's going on, sir?
Well, actually, before the 1980 law, the situation was worse in that the U.S. government, you and I as taxpayers, would fund billions and billions of dollars of research. And then when the research was done, if there was something patentable, the patent would, every federal agency had its own policy on patenting, but basically the patents would be turned back to the federal government. And that meant that prior to 1980, there were thousands, some people believe as many as 28,000 patented inventions that were just sitting on the shelves in a figurative sense, but the government had them, and only 4% of them were being licensed. Now,
really?
Now,
so they just sat there and collected dust?
Yeah, they were collecting dust, but a lot of those you and I wouldn't want to be licensed because a lot of them, for example, were military technology patents. But
fair enough.
But there was a big chunk of technology there that wasn't being utilized. And your listeners who remember from the 80s, you know, in the 80s, we were very worried about the rise of Japan and American economic competitiveness. And so a bunch of actions were taken, and one of them was this very bipartisan Buy-Dole Act. Senator Dole and Senator Buy led the effort, and a government-wide decision was made that the results of federally funded research and development would be transferred, if the universities wanted it, to the universities and the nonprofits who did the research. And then they, in turn, could license it out. So if you think about it that way, Steve, that's a great idea because that means, well, then the licensing money will come back to universities and support higher education, and that's all something we should want. But then, because this is the 80s and we're worried about American economic competitiveness as we are today,
sure.
The federal government said, okay, but you need to make it in America. So if it's a new pharmaceutical, you need to make it in America. If it's a new improvement on semiconductor manufacturing, you need to do it in America. unless you get a waiver from the federal agency involved that says it just really can't be done in the United States. And that's
so they find an escape hatch on the back of the legislation and use it.
Well, you know, the problem is we don't even know if they're using it. That is, in the sense that there's each person who has a license, if they can't make it in America, is supposed to get a waiver, a formal waiver from the federal agency that gave them money. I don't think, and anyone I've ever talked to doesn't think that's actually what's happening. It may be happening with the National Institute of Health for their grants, because they have an online form to apply for the waiver. But even if those applications are happening, there's no evidence that anyone at NIH is really scrutinizing them in the way that Congress intended in 1980.
So how do we turn this around then, and how do we get American ideas? Well, American university ideas, I guess it doesn't matter where the people originated from, but American ideas into the hands of American industry to power this country going forward.
Well, you know, this isn't a golden arrow or anything, but it is something that could make a difference in thousands of jobs. And what we need to do is we need to enforce the law. The Department of Commerce needs to step up to the plate. And this back in the Obama administration, the National Academy of Sciences figured this out, and they said, it's a great system, but we don't really know what's happening. We aren't monitoring it. We aren't auditing it. We aren't enforcing it. And the Department of Commerce needs to sit down in there and say, okay, we're going to assemble a team and audit all these, at least spot audits, start spot auditing, see, is everybody manufacturing in America? Do all the licenses have this requirement in them? Do all the assignments of the patents have this requirement? And when people have gotten waivers, you know, were they realistic waivers? Were they just kind of pro forma waivers? Ah, sure, you can make it outside the U.S. Was there any serious enforcement? And if we find cases where there wasn't, and I actually have good reason to think that there's a lot of manufacturing or a lot of the use of our patented technology outside the U.S. that they never got waivers.
Right, a lot of shenanigans going on because there's no oversight. Unfortunately, Professor, we have to leave it there for today, but you've brought our attention to something extremely important that I think we should be pursuing in the future, and I think we should extend our conversation sometime soon as well, because this is an important consideration about buying American and making sure that, well, when we invest our tax dollars, they go to the right place. Thank you, sir.
Exactly. Thank you for having me.
Justin Hughes, a professor teaching international trade and intellectual property courses at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Some final thoughts after this quick break on the Steve Gruber Show.